everyone. It is really nice to be here. I just flew here from Portland, Oregon, and it was miserable and rainy, so you are very lucky that you get to be here on a daily basis. All right, I'm going to talk to you about a few different things that are on my mind. One, distributed computing. Two, calm technology. And three, maybe something relevant to what you want me to talk about. Who has seen this quote, that 50 billion devices are going to be online by 2020? Okay, so a lot of these conferences, especially a couple of years ago, people like to throw this quote around. It's usually that at some point in the future, if we have enough technology, everything will be solved and we won't have any problems anymore. I really love it when people say that because I like to break that apart really nice by showing them horrible examples of where it does go wrong. But we can avoid that. There are ways to deal with these things. So I like to ask like whether any of these things actually sound good. Consider when the smartwatch came out and it just had the same alerts that you had on your phone and you had to artificially like go through each thing and say, no, don't show this calendar alert up on my phone and don't show the cookie collector game alert on my watch and don't keep looking at this yet another piece of interruptive data. And then for a while, and this still happens, I get these calls from trend research companies and they say, how do you make the smart appliance? How do you make the smart fridge? We're with a big company, we want to make something really special. And I say, stop it. Like, we need smarter people, not smarter devices. Like, where are you guys going? Like, people have actually said, like, well, let's have a fridge that you have a payment plan sign up to, and somebody goes to your house and, like, sets it up for you, and you can put in your profile of what you want to eat or not. Or if you're, like, diabetic, then you can have it, like, lock you out of certain things. I'm like, well, I store all the sweets in the cupboards. My cupboards are not smart. So if I get locked out of my fridge because it says I can't eat sweets, then I'll just go to my not-smart cupboard who's not going to restrict any of the behavior. Or if I have to use my thumbprint to get into the fridge every time because it's smart and I'm cooking and my hands are covered with cookie dough, I won't be able to get into my fridge. Or if my diabetic friend comes over and like they need some food like immediately and I have to like install the latest virus update because my fridge DDoSed attack to the web last night, then it's just going to suck. So when you put all these things together, you get what I like to call the dystopian kitchen of the future, in which everything's written in a different programming language. Some of the devices are cooler than others, which means they're written in a cooler programming language, which means that's just a programming language that's supported for like 2 years before everybody leaves and leaves behind undocumented, unsupportable code that's a big tangle pile of crap. And then you get all of the things trying to communicate with each other and having to do the software updates. And because they're not written really well, they just send all these packet updates through your wireless connection that's already flooded because you're trying to like stream Game of Thrones 24/7 because you're depressed and you're on this crazy binge because you couldn't get your refrigerator to work. I don't want this future to happen at all. I would prefer that we had really dumb appliances that worked, like mid-century modern appliances. You can keep them around for 50 years. You can take them apart if you want to. It's not really a big deal. Like when you get home, you shouldn't have to be a system administrator to live in your own freaking home. And if you do, then that's because it's your job and you really want to mess with your home that way. I grew up in a bunch of different smart homes because my dad was always like hacking into the walls and adding like wireless internet. And then everything that didn't work, he would give me those devices. And so I had like a bunch of really badly functioning technology in my room when I grew up. My favorite was the voice-activated light switch. People love the idea in movies of voice-activated technology. You can always tell the computer something in your perfect San Francisco English accent and have it understand you every single time because it's a film and you can have 40 takes. But in real life, you have to like really articulate to Alexa. My favorite thing is to go into people's houses and just start ordering stuff on their Alexa list. Like, send diapers to this house, you know? And they're like, please, they confirm. Okay, confirmed. And then they're like, hey, what are you doing? I'm like, well, there's something persistently listening to me in your house. I might as well, like, make you aware of it. This is my favorite story of connected technology gone wrong. So there's this startup called PetNet.io. And they say, look, you don't have to worry about leaving your animals at home anymore. You can have this thing set up. It'll automatically like make a little chime for your animal, and then you can have it automatically feed, right? Which you can do anyway with a non-internet connected device. But you have Skype for your animals too. So if your animals get lonely, you can just Skype them from your phone and, hey, Fido, how's it going? I'm sorry I'm out for like 5 days. I probably shouldn't own an animal. So guess what happens with this technology? They didn't have time to implement the idea that if this thing breaks and disconnects from the web or their servers fail, that it could still keep feeding the animals. So they forgot to implement that part, and then this happened. Right, it's really sad. But it's not sad enough that regulations might be put in place to actually protect things when they go offline. Like, imagine if you had a web-connected, like, insulin pump or, like, pacemaker, and, oh, sorry, Amazon Web Services went down, and, you know, I like Amazon Web Services, but anyway, the idea is that there was no liability that was given here to the company. They said, we're not responsible if our server goes down, because how can you control that anymore? We didn't build infrastructure, especially in the United States, like we did for electricity. We can't rely on this the way that we would electricity, because electricity was like, yeah, we're going to electrify everything, and everyone's going to have it from a farmhouse in the middle of nowhere to like a city. I mean, if we were sitting in here and electricity were as unreliable as the web, we'd have like the lights kind of dim every once in a while, and we just have to deal with it. But we don't. We can rely on it. So we're building these technologies that attempt to rely on the web in a way that it isn't set up for. And we can't really change that unless we really invest in infrastructure. And we have a really stretchy country, and it's really hard to do that in a cheap way. So these pets got in trouble, and nobody did anything about it because they didn't have to. There's no reason to do it. So we have this era of interruptive technology, and we need the opposite. So I was writing my thesis on mobile phones in like 2007, and I found this term called calm technology. I said, okay, where did this come from? And of course it comes from Xerox PARC, where like half of our stuff has come from, like Ethernet and modern web user interface. And these guys, Mark Wise and John Seely Brown, had enough funding to create the future really early on. And so they said that the future is going to be a world filled with pads, tabs, and boards. Basically what everybody has in this room. This is a board, and you have pads and tablets and things like that. And they said, We'll even have these cool badges that you can wear, because computers would take 15 minutes to start up in like the 80s and 90s. And so when you walk into Xerox PARC to go to work in the morning, it'll automatically turn on your computer in the background. So by the time you get your coffee, your computer's on. It was all this like just-in-time, like location-based technology. And they built this, and they wrote these great papers like The Coming Age of Calm Technology, the idea that like there would be, instead of many people to one computer on a mainframe, we'd have many devices to one person. And what they found is that the scarce resource in the 21st century wasn't going to be technology. That would get incredibly cheap. It wouldn't be a $50,000 badge you'd wear. It would be like this tiny thing in your pocket. But that we would have limits on our attention, and that we would have to figure out how to make technology that dwelled within our lives in a nice way instead of a really annoying way. And my favorite other paper from them was called The World Is Not a Desktop. And they said, okay, there's going to be a bunch of people who are designing everything like it's a desktop, where we can pay all of our attention right here in this nice space and absorb everything, and that's just not how the future is going to be. And right now, I mean, if you're driving and your primary attention is on the road, your secondary attention is on your rearview mirror, your tertiary attention is on like the pedal and maybe the radio knob so that you can change the channel, every time you use your phone and pick it up, it switches your primary attention from the road to here. All the variables get thrown out, and then in that 2 or 3 seconds to like come back to attention, you get in an accident, because these are not necessarily designed in a way that makes good use of our attention. And not every single notification that we get on our phones is the right notification we should receive. So let's talk about how do we actually design calm technology. I went through their papers, and they had some advice. I added a little bit of advice to it, and then I'll break it up a little bit later. So one of their terms was that technology shouldn't be requiring all of our attention, just some of it, and only when necessary. The example that they gave is a tea kettle. You set the tea kettle, you forget it, and it calls to you from another room. Like, who watches a tea kettle? Like, you don't need to watch a tea kettle. You shouldn't have to watch all these processes going on. It should let you know. In the same way that when you turn off an Apple TV, for a long time it would say, when you turn it on, like, they'd say, hey, you need to update the Apple TV software. It's like, no, I was trying to watch a video, I don't want to update the software right then. And then they switched it. And so when you turn it off the Apple TV now, it says, we're going to download these updates and then we'll turn it off. Why isn't it designed in a way that you don't need to download all these updates? Like, of course there needs to be all these updates and we can't get rid of that. But where those updates are downloaded and when and why really matters a lot. The second one is that technology should empower the periphery. We have all this peripheral attention. How much of it do we actually use? Not that much of it. This is the LumoBack Smart Posture Sensor. I can see people kind of straightening up their backs. The idea is that you wear it, and it will give you a tiny buzz when you're slouching, so that only when you need it, only when it notices, you get like this little buzz, and then you're reminded, and eventually you have good posture, something like this. But the idea is that it uses a different notification. It's a personal notification. I had an employee that was getting an insulin pump installed, and he was really excited, and then I met him for a one-on-one on the next week, and I heard this beep, and I said, "Your insulin pump is beeping," and he said, "I can't turn it off." And I said, "Well, that's got to be really annoying." He said, "Yeah, I went to a wedding, I went to a funeral, I went to a movie, and then I went to a concert. Everybody else could hear my insulin pump and think I was being really annoying and rude in those three quiet events, and then I needed my insulin, and I couldn't hear the beep when it was really loud." And I said, "Well, if you were in a caretaking facility where somebody else was like paying attention to you and like providing this thing for you, it would be good if they could hear it. But you need a personal, like a buzz, because when it's really loud, you can still feel the buzz. It's a personal notification." And the issue is that the device manufacturer didn't think of that. They said, "Well, we'll just make it beep." No sound design, no volume control, no turn it off, no change it to a different notification. And so this guy was stuck with this really expensive device that was supposed to free him and bring him back to the norm of a human with like nice insulin regulation. And yet he was stuck in these horrible situations that he couldn't get himself out of, and people thought he was rude because they didn't understand that he had an insulin pump. So empowering the periphery can be really helpful, and also changing the buzzes on something can be helpful too. Like as we move from mega mansions into cities, into tiny little condos, do we bring these really loud washers and dryers and dishwashers with us? Like the idea in a really large house is that we'd have these in different zones, and you want to hear the washer and dryer go off when it's done because it's far away. But you don't want this really loud noise in this tiny 500 square foot place. So being able to change this notification is incredibly and increasingly important. Technology should give you information in a calming manner. How many of you have seen these It's a new day. It's like the Microsoft like utopian day, you know, like a single guy in a condo who can speak to his voice recognition system perfectly every time, and then like the computerized voice wakes him up in the morning and is like, "Hello, you have all these notifications," and you know, it's all spoken. Like that would be such a horrible environment to wake up in. And maybe he has somebody over for the night and like they get woken up by like this guy's personal appointment. It's just like, unless it's in a video and it's like in that perfect like just segment of reality, it's not going to work out. So my solution to this was building, this was my old kitchen. It was just this weather connected light bulb. I was like, well, if my light bulbs are going to connect to the web, why not add it to the weather report? So I would wake up in the morning and I would see the color of the light, and it would tell me what the weather was going to be like for the day. This is like empowering your peripheral attention. So of course this would just be dark blue every day because it was raining every day in Portland, but every once in a while I'd walk into my kitchen, it would be like a beautiful sunny yellow, and I'd be like, yes, I can go outside today, this is great. This is the most important part that a lot of people get wrong with millions and millions of dollars of investment, and you can kind of see these products when they go wrong. If you amplify the best of technology and the best of humanity, you have something that works together really well. But oftentimes, often because of films, you see these people who have said, well, let's make a robot that looks like a human and it'll serve tea. Why? Like, a better version is like a Roomba robot. Like, it's shaped like a trilobite, like a filter feeder, like suckerfish, like from the prehistoric times. Like, that's the shape of what it does, right? It's a vacuum cleaner, it's robotic, it calls to you and goes dee 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 instead of saying, I am done cleaning the floor. It just has a beep and it says ding, and then if it gets stuck, it goes dun dun, and then you can go pick it up and help it out. Because you're helping the piece of technology, it's a lot more adorable, and cats can write on top of it in YouTube videos, instead of it being like this disastrous and incredibly expensive machine that like breaks down because it has arms and legs and a head and like tries to talk to you. Like, why do you need that? You just need the least amount of technology to get the thing done. Plus, if you try to make machines that act like humans, it's always uncanny valley. They're creepy. And then if you, it's really, really creepy. And then when you try to automate everything, you can get really stuck, like the checkout counters. I love looking at the automated checkout counters at grocery stores because it's just filled with a bunch of people like, huh, what do I scan? What's the code? And then there's all these people that are hired now to just like help them with the machine. And then everybody's apologizing on each other's behalf, but they're really apologizing for the technology. It's just a total mess. But what I really like to see is like simple things like this. Like Google, of course, is not simple, but what you can do is put your search term in. It's not making the decision for you of what you want to see, which is why they removed the I'm feeling lucky button, because it doesn't help. But then it goes through all this stuff with a bunch of bots behind the scenes, and then it gives you a sheet of 10 results, and you as the human know the context. Humans are so good at curation and making decisions and applying it to a specific situation that they have the context and embodied knowledge for. And the computer's really good at sifting through like a ton of results and like messing with lots and lots of data. So when you marry those two together in like a command line for the web like this, you get something fairly nice. And then the other biggest issue that I find is that the more you automate, the more customer service becomes really important. Like the minute something's really automated, like one of those phone tree systems, people just press 0000000, just try to get to a human. Like the human understands this interface better than like you calling in and not understanding it. And so if they can guide you through it, that's great. But even better is just to call your customer support department and say, what are the number 1, 2, and 3 issues that people call in from, and then improve the user experience of the site in like these tiny little ways until you get less and less of these support issues so that you can focus on what people really need to do instead of redesigning the whole thing and thinking it'll be better. And I've got hired by many companies who are like, let's redesign the whole thing. And then I'm like, well, you have to train up customer support to deal with your existing system and your legacy system. It's going to be horrible. And then you'll have like 2 sets of customer support calls. Let's see if I can play this video here. So my friend Russ Goodwin does these weird things where he'll just do machine learning of a bunch of scripts. So what he did with this is he said, let's just grab a bunch of data from all these science fiction scripts and let's start to automate and design a script. And then let's have the main character for Silicon Valley act it out with a bunch of people. And of course, it ended up being like really horrible. I'll just play you a few. This is like they put like 2001 A Space Odyssey and like Cowboys and Aliens and like a bunch of good scripts and bad scripts in there. So here we go.
In a future with mass unemployment, young people are forced to sell blood. It's something I can do.
You should see the boy and shut up. I was the one who was going to be 100 years old.
I saw him again. The way you were sent to me, that was a big, honest idea. I am not a bright light.
Well, I have to go to the skull. I don't know.
So that's an idea of like right now, if you want to generate a script, like you can get something like that. And us as humans and us as actors are going to try to make sense of it. It's actually kind of reasonable if you want to like write a thesis about it, but it's not something that you would like want to look at on Netflix like all the time. But where automation goes right is this guy, Todd Huffman, he said, there are all of these people who are trying to take like skin samples for biopsy. And usually you get like a two-dimensional skin sample and somebody has to train for like 18 months to get the skin sample in the machine and you scan it. And then you might be able to predict like melanoma or something like that. So what he did is he said, well, I'll take a three-dimensional core sample, make a robot that scans it, because it's really tedious for humans to do, kind of like bricklaying or any of these things that like we've tried to automate and actually done a good job at. And what it does is it just takes this diamond knife, cuts up this three-dimensional core sample, scans it into 3D, and then takes it into a database of all these other core samples, and so you can predict faster than a doctor could what's going to happen to this person over time, because you have way more data. This is interesting. It's also 1,500 times faster than a human can do it. And the humans that train up for this can maybe do it for like 7 years before their eyesight and like hands fail, because it's just this really horrible thing. So in these cases, like things that are really tedious for humans to do that require a lot of training and expertise on like a tedium point of view, you can really change them and automate them in that case. And then you can train it up on all the diagnosis and all of that data. And that's really interesting. It doesn't apply to everything. It's kind of the same with like self-driving cars. Like, if you want to train a self-driving car really well, couldn't you just take all the data of the local drivers and put that into a database, and then like you know where somebody's going, and it downloads into the car, and then everybody who's driving will drive like a local in each of those places? Maybe that could be slightly better. But the whole point is that you can have the human part and the machine part, and they connect together in more of a symbiosis than just trying to like automate something without any other input. And it has this kind of, we lost this term, cybernetic feedback loop that improves things over time. I was asked to speak on a panel at Cannes about this Drum magazine, and they said, it's a magazine made by an AI. And I said, no way, like you can't just do that. And they said, well, we put a bunch of data into, which was just really like a team of 20 people working on Watson, pretending that it's an AI. But they put all this data in, and then what it was is they would tell you, like the computer, aided by all these humans, would tell you, like, you should have the text be this large, and you should put a caption under this image, and that will improve the readability, and that will increase the amount of time that people will spend on the page. And so they took all of this advice from the AI, which is way better, and then they used their curatorial understanding to like make a magazine. And the issue was actually pretty good. And they didn't do anything else. Like, they didn't compare the readership or like the page time to any of the other magazine issues. Like, it was like, there's this lost opportunity. Like, did it really improve or not the readability? But the whole big thing was like, we made it with AI. And every time somebody says this, it makes me really mad. Which is why I'd like to bring up the Ouroboros type thing. There's this snake that eats its own tail until it destroys itself. So right now, we might have all this algorithmic data, and then if we feed it into itself continuously without any new input, we just have this kind of algorithm that eats itself. We'll get really great television shows, and then there'll be the same great television show plots, and then there'll be a template for producing those television shows, and then we'll milk all of that, and then it will just die because there won't be any new data. Versus like having 20 to 30% of a budget say, let's have all these weird like Tumblr subculture people and like let's have them write weird scripts or like the fan fiction libraries, and like they know what they want, and it's a whole subculture of people that's completely underrepresented, and see what happens, and put that metadata into the machine and then see what happens from there. Like, there needs to be like a little bit fresh data, or you never realize like the next Shakespeare or any of like these core like mythological type script things that we can then reappropriate again and again and again. Like, there's just these pieces that you miss. So I don't want to see this happening. I see a lot of companies that are like, well, we'll just, you know, do algorithms like this, and then we'll just make the best thing. I had a friend that did that. He made like 400 iPhone apps over the course of a year and a half, and they were really crappy, and they made money for a while, and after a while it just like emptied out, and then he couldn't compete in the market anymore because he hadn't been working on quality, he just worked on quantity. And so it looked really cool for the bottom line for his revenue, and then it just ate itself, and it sucked. So this is why I'm looking at weird things like Twitch TV. I think that there's two kind of content watchers emerging. One is like the ambient content watcher. Like, not only do they just want a stream of constant music or noise because they're like in their condo alone and they like need the idea that there's a group of people around them while they do really boring tasks on the web where they get paid remote. Or there's the people who are like, I'm on a subway and I want something really interactive to take my time that's not like Cookie Collector or Super Mario Brothers. And so you can have this like super interactive content on one side where you're really into the story, which you're seeing a lot in Japan, or you have this ambient background noise. So my partner has this channel on all the time, this particular channel where like the Zelda game came out and like everyone was like, oh, cool. And so this guy goes and just explores it 5 days a week for 8 hours at a time, and he gets paid $50,000, $60,000 a year for this. And so people are supporting this content, right? It's, I'm not playing the video game because I don't have time, but I can watch somebody else play the video game in the background and feel like I'm hanging out with my friend. And so I'm seeing this whole new genre of people that are just like, okay, this is what's happening. And then Twitch takes 50% of the revenue, and then the gamer takes 50% of the revenue. And, you know, they're really rated on, like, are they keeping the content fresh? Are they acting weird? Are they making jokes? Like, are they thinking they're subscribers? And it's like this, like, usually, like, one-person show. But this kind of like ambient background stuff is interesting to watch. And then this, who has heard of this? Don't go to it if you, I mean, if you don't already know what it is. But the idea of this is like you have lots and lots of non-standard relationship fanfics on popular culture. And I was just in Santa Cruz and went to this conference on social fiction. And all the students there, it was like 3D printing a Tumblr audience out into the room. I'm like, wow, look at all the Tumblr subcultures. And they were talking about how with really bad sex education in schools, they were learning their sex education from fan fiction. And we had these like discussions on this with like a bunch of people who are studying social theory. And they said, well, I didn't see any of this represented in television, so I just went online and found it. And I was like, okay, you guys are all paying a lot of money now for like all of this fan merchandise. If anything in the media, it doesn't have to be mainstream media, but niche media actually represented any of this. Like there's just like all of these like hidden revenue streams that you can get that would represent them. And you can actually do a bunch of data now. People are just like data mining this site to see like what are the most popular pairings and like what's represented. And so if you want to go off and do that, feel free. You don't need to tell me anything about it, but it's interesting. So I'll just leave that there. Another thing that's curious is what people are doing where they're just like studying colors and like studying scenes. So like there's like the ability to study just the colors of something. So you could say, well, people really like this genre of material, like Mr. Robot is definitely going to look like this. And then maybe this person really likes, you know, really bright colors like Adventure Time. And you could suggest content based on like the color scheme of something. Like there's just all these other weird variables you can look at that are really easy to digest for a computer, aren't as easy to digest for a human. And you can start bubbling up that content to see if it actually works. And then Facebook reactions. Like, the minute this was implemented, it wasn't a binary like or unlike. It was just a, hey, now there's more options. And the minute you have that, then you can really start to get more understanding of what people like or not, or why they like it or why they don't, and bubble that up based on somebody's mood. You just watch this, you're more likely to be in an angry mood, so we'll just suggest more angry content or, like, content to soothe you down or something like that. I don't know. But there's so much stuff to do with this once you get more granular reactions like this. Decision-making, again, with the ambient background information. A lot of people don't want to make a lot of these choices. Like, they're going to call their friends, what did you watch? It's kind of like decision-making when you're hungry and you get presented with a menu like this. There's absolutely no hierarchy of what it is. Like, I just want pictures and I want to point and say, I want red meat or I want lettuce. And then people try to, like, make it better by putting these categories on it, it's still the exact same mess. Like, I just want to know, which is why you ask a person, what do you like? Can you make a decision for me? And if they're like a bad waiter or waitress, they'll say, well, I haven't eaten anything, I don't know. Or they would say, what are you in the mood for? And then they'll tell you exactly what you want. That's why I like staff picks, like Powell's Bookstore does this, and then they have a digital version of it where they're like, we're tastemakers, we read lots of books, we care, here's the books you should read. And then sometimes it gets done really wrong. Like, I've bought lots of stuff from Nordstrom, but this is my, like, this isn't even my color palette. Come on. I don't even wear flowy dresses. I don't understand, like, how could you get it so wrong? But if I had, like, a person that I admired and I saw their clothing picks, which is why people go on all these blog sites, then heck yeah, I would say, yeah, I like that and that and that, and I could click on it. Which is why, like, on Spotify, there's a lot of tastemakers that are hired specifically to make good playlists. And yes, this is the stuff that I listen to on Spotify, and it's accurate, and I like most of it, and they've done a great job. So that's reasonable. But it's because there's a really important human curatorial part that says, I have a taste in this shape, and it's similar to your shape, and maybe I'll get some of it right, and maybe I'll get some of it wrong, but it'll be a lot better than a computer assuming that it knows what you like. So finally, technology should make use of the near and the far. I kind of have this prediction graph where in the past we had mainframes and there were a lot of people per mainframe and they were far away from you and then everybody had a desktop and the software would show up on the desktop through a CD-ROM, you'd load it and then it would be stable for 1 or 2 years except for service packs, 1s, 2, 3, and 4 or whatever. And then you would have, now you have like the remote mainframes again where like, can you actually go to see your data on Facebook? It's out there in like the Dalles, Oregon somewhere, and like they will not let you in. I've tried to go in there. Hey, my data's in here. It's mine, right? Can I just go into the server facility? No, you can't come in. This is copyright data, but I own the data. No, you can't come in. But then what I see is happening is this kind of personal servers where like we have all this computing power, on our phones, and bandwidth is going to become very, very expensive, and switching from all these different providers is going to become very expensive. And the main thing for streaming is that we don't have the advantage of television where you're like, it's free signals, you just need a transmitter through the air, and people just listen on these like nice little antennas. No, you have to deal with servers, and it's expensive, and it sucks. So if you process a lot on the device itself, or you start to do things like distributed computing, where it's kind of like a Napster moment again, where instead of everybody in your apartment complex downloading Game of Thrones at the same time, you'll download part of Game of Thrones through your next door neighbor and part of it from somebody like in the next neighborhood, and then maybe 20 or 10 or 5% will be downloaded from, like, say, Netflix's servers. That's going to reduce all the server costs, because that's the thing that's going to really eat a lot of people. Either you can put the data in, that's fine, but getting it out, it's going to become increasingly expensive. And who's out there trying to improve the infrastructure? I don't know. Like, go talk to, I don't know, some bigger company and say, hey, can you make the bandwidth better in the United States? Like, until we do that, we need to be really smart around adopting technologies that allow us to chunk up our content and distribute it to people so that people become nodes instead of just, like, the main server. It also improves the distribution because you don't have like a big like server attack that like takes out all your stuff. So the downtime could be less, more of this stuff is stored on each other's devices. So in finality, if good design allows people to accomplish their goals in the least amount of moves, then calm technology allows people to accomplish their goals with the least amount of mental cost. And that's the biggest issue that we're having right now. We're overwhelmed by everything, and we really need to focus on the mental cost part. And finally, what should we automate? Not as least as possible, or like things that we don't want to do as a human. What shouldn't we automate? I don't know, hanging out with your kids, like watching a sunset. Should we have time to do that without a beep, beep? There's an emergency message from your server is down and your pet is dying sort of thing. So, and again, this quote, scarce resources are attention, not technology. There's a site called Calm Tech. There's principles on it. I also wrote a book on this. The end. Thank you so much.
Amber Case. Thank you so much. And we ran out of time, but the great news is you're joining our panel. So if you do have questions for Amber, let's save it for the next session.